And of course, we are waiting now on the contract signing, which would be, without a doubt, the biggest news in the history of this sport.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 82 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and today I'll be taking a look at WCW Worldwide from June 25th, 1994. Yes, I finally got there. I promised this, I think, 3 weeks ago or something now, and then I got sick with, as I described in last week's Best Of episode, Best of the Heel Turns, Volume 2. I hope you check that out. And along with everything else in the back catalog going back about a year and a half. And this show here from June 25th, as I said, it's 2 days after the Clash of the Champions 27. When you get up that high, you kind of forget what number a clash it was. You just kind of go by the month and year, so you call it the June 94 clash, and those only last until 1997 anyway, and then we get a weekly Thursday Thunder out of it in the aftermath of that, and the less said the better. I'm hoping to do a Thunder at some point when I have the energy and when I find one that is short enough, maybe with things cut out. But yes, that clash featured the debut of Hulk Hogan, at least in sort of an active role, and Ric Flair unifies the WCW World Heavyweight title along with the WCW International title, the ridiculous thing that was created out of the split from the NWA the year before, which kind of had to do with these worldwide tapings, as the governing body of the NWA didn't particularly care for the fact that title changes were being telegraphed 3 and 4 months in advance, and they thought that wasn't exactly the best thing to kind of keep kayfabe for whatever that was in the mid-90s. But hey, you know, what are you going to do? This is the point around now when they bring in Hulk Hogan, and they decided to take their shot, and they do the toast and everything, and they say, to the next step. The difference between WCW 1994 and the movie American Pie, which I'm basing that on, is American Pie was all about those guys getting laid in some form or fashion, whereas WCW, it was really only about Hulk Hogan's ego getting laid, as it turned out, with all the cronies coming in. But I'll have a lot more to say about that as I get into the show. But let me get in my plugs real quick. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GFAllentownPod. And be sure to check out the new and improved ProWrestlingOnly.com. I was on it a little bit earlier today, and there's a portal that has all these magazine covers from the 1980s. You dig deeply into the site, and it's invaluable for research in terms of just kind of getting people's takes on various matches and stuff like that. I've used that a lot of different times to just kind of, you know, take the temperature of the room, as it were. But right now, I'm looking at this thread. It's under magazines, and just looking at these old covers, I like to count how many guys are got a crimson mask on the cover of these old magazines. I'm just scrolling through 1983 right now, and it's actually surprisingly low. You'd think that there would be more of it. I see Dusty has one, and then Ric Flair has one. Actually, Harley Race and Ric Flair, because it's the both of them. It's the October 83 issue of The Wrestler. But do check that out. And of course, placetobenation.com. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon for all your Amazon purchases. I think I said that I bought that Bob Woodward book off Amazon recently. I think I'm going to be buying more coffee from New Mexico. And yes, I am going to go into my vanity segment here about my trip to New Mexico, because there's a lot to get to, starting with the fact that if you like coffee, you know, everybody talks about Portland and Seattle and those places being great coffee towns, but it was impossible to find a bad cup of coffee in the state of New Mexico. Now, I did not go to any Indian casinos or anything like that. In fact, I never set foot in a casino the entire time I was there. But I also never had a single bad cup of coffee, which was, you know, pretty incredible in my opinion. Also incredible is the food scene in New Mexico. And I have to admit, I kind of lucked out in terms of when we went to the state, staying in Santa Fe instead of Albuquerque. I did spend a couple of days down in Albuquerque, and it is kind of a quick drive down there because it's one of those states out in the west that has a 75-mile-an-hour speed limit, which is nice because it makes that 55-mile trip go by a lot quicker. Whereas on the East Coast, you're used to these, you know, weird, arbitrary 45-mile-an-hour speed limits through the cities because, you know, they have to, you know, curve the roads and all this sort of stuff. So it's easier to get out to places. But about the food, New Mexico is known for its chili, particularly the green and the red chili. And when you combine them, you know, they call it Christmas chili. I didn't really have too many combinations of it together. It was either make a choice, green or red, baby face or heel, you know, whatever. I'm choosing green over red overall, just because I think I like it on more stuff. I had the red on some pork early in the week, but the green works well because one of the great New Mexico foods is the green chili cheeseburger, and I had one of those at Santa Fe Bite. A very good red. I mean, I'm not going to go chapter and verse through every single restaurant, but suffice to say, if you're ever going to Santa Fe, New Mexico, I can certainly recommend a few things to you, because I think I went just about everywhere. Went to a place called Woo's Donuts, which that put Ric Flair in my head, just the fact that it's called Woo's Donuts. And it was also during the couple of days where all the pictures from Flair's wedding or commitment ceremony, whatever the hell he was calling it, and now I have Michael Hayes with the pink fanny pack or whatever the hell he had on just in my head, and then spooky Undertaker. And anyway, they had a really good blue corn lavender donut that I think I had three of over the course of the week. And it was also recommended to me by a dude in a bar called Cowgirls Barbecue, which is pretty good. He was high as a kite, clearly, but I don't really mind that. I was a little bit peeved that he was hitting on my wife and, you know, the hand on the shoulder thing. So I'm kind of glaring over at him as I'm drinking a $12 glass of bourbon, the most expensive one they had, because it is better to pay $12 for your glass of bourbon that comes from a bottle that retails for $125. It's kind of like buying a timeshare in the bottle of bourbon. I feel like that was a very good money spent by me. But in terms of the food, we lucked out because the state fair is going on in Albuquerque, and of course they have all kinds of crazy foods down there. I figured the one that won the crazy food prize, or actually it was called the unique foods winner of the 2018 New Mexico State Fair, the item is called deep fried bacon green chili mozzarella stick, which under ordinary circumstances, you know, I'd be willing to try that and all. However, given my recent digestive issues, I decided maybe to play it safe and have more traditional stuff. And we went on the day that, you know, a lot of the places were offering $3 specials, sort of like mini versions of like Frito pie and stuff like that, and just go around and have that. I mean, it's going to be enough. But as if that's not enough, in Santa Fe, at the plaza in the center of town, they had this annual fiesta that has this parade, and there's food trucks and basically all kinds of food stands set up around the center of town, this plaza. So there's certainly plenty to eat, which is great, but you can't just eat when you go on vacation. And we kind of got lucky in another regard, in that there's a venue, a very cool concert venue out in Santa Fe. That's just north of the downtown by about 4 or 5 miles, and it's called the Santa Fe Opera, which, yes, they mostly have opera there. In fact, in front of the seats, they have translations. So when you go see something like Pagliacci or something and you don't understand it has a little translation there for you that goes into English and Spanish because they know their audience. But occasionally, they'll have a rock show there. And the B-52s played that venue on the Monday night when we were there. It was a really good show, but the venue itself is fantastic, very reminiscent of Red Rocks out in Colorado, which is generally regarded as maybe the coolest amphitheater in the United States. I know that U2 did the Under Blood Red Sky. I want to say they did that at Red Rocks back in the early 80s. I forget what year. Also that same week, Robert Plant played at the Santa Fe Opera on Thursday. So I'd like to go back to tell 16-year-old me that, yeah, you could have gone to Robert Plant or the B-52s, and you willingly chose the B-52s. Quite frankly, it was fun. And funny enough, we noticed that the hotel we were staying in was a sponsor of the B-52 show, and we get back, we're drinking at the hotel bar, not unlike, you know, the aforementioned Ric Flair or anything like that, but the B-52s walk in as we are going to our room, and we give them the elevator, and we just have like this awkward interaction where, like, Kate, the redhead from there, like, well, thanks for being there at the show. And it's like, we don't want to cram into the elevator with these people who are like between 60 and 70 years old who just did the show for us. And then I thought to myself, oh crap, Robert Plant might be in this hotel 3 days from now. Turns out I never saw him, but I was afraid for a while that he was going to tear the place apart like in his Led Zeppelin heyday or anything like that. I will actually recommend one restaurant that apparently we had seen, my wife and I, on the Food Channel before going there, called Sazon, S-A-Z-O-N, where I had halibut in the middle of New Mexico, which you wouldn't think to order fish there, but it came with this great verde mole. Apparently, they sell their moles online, and I think I'll be looking out to buy some of that down the road. So, yeah. Bottom line is, I recommend New Mexico very highly. In fact, I think it is shot to the top of the list of my favorite states in the United States. I think it is now past Nevada because, quite frankly, as I said earlier, I am over casinos. But hey, at the end of the day, I'm just a guy who doesn't know who Puma King is. And I've learned in the past week that that is very important that I find out who Puma King is because, as somebody who does a podcast that is released to the world, not knowing who Puma King is very embarrassing. So here I am anyway. And what can we do? I mean, other than just watch a bunch of Puma King matches, but I really don't have time for that right now. So Hogan's arrived in WCW as this show begins, but other stuff is still in place. So Hogan shows up, it's not like everything changes right away. Sort of like when he shows up at the end of 83 for that taping in St. Louis and then shows up in Allentown taping beginning of January 84. That time felt like everything in the WWF was changing on a dime. WCW, not so much, because there were a few moving pieces to get to the Hulk Hogan crony era. His guys are not entirely in place. Yes, some of them are there, like the former Big Boss Man, who is actually going to be on this show. Jesse Ventura, on the other side, sworn enemy of Hulk Hogan. He is still there in an announcer capacity, but he had been greatly phased down once Bobby Heenan had shown up at the beginning of the year. As I said, you got the Guardian Angel, which was the name that the Big Boss Man was going by at this time. They're still trying to figure out something to do with him. The Guardian Angel is the sort of ode to the actual group of, I'm not sure, security force, I think would be the best way of putting it, what the Guardian Angels actually are. Brian Pillman and Steve Austin are on the show, obviously not together because the Hollywood Blondes had to be broken up in 93 because, goddamn it, they were responsible for that low rating at the Clash of the Champions 23, and for not because nobody cared about wrestling in June of 1993. It was all their fault. Ric Flair's returning. How dare these two guys drag Ric Flair down? Now they're on separate, very divergent paths as Austin is a champion and Pillman is just kind of floating around. And I've been reading that Brian Pillman book that came out, I want to say last year, Crazy Like a Fox, and let's just say it has lived up to the billing that people have said about it to me. We're also going to see Frank Anderson, WCW short timer, on this show, and also a guy who recently passed away. I was kind of shocked to see that. I decided I was doing the show, and I noticed that Frank Anderson was on there, and I thought, what am I going to have to say about him? And then I look it up a couple of days later, and I see that he had passed away at the age of, I believe it was 62, and I had not yet seen a eulogy done by Lance Storm, so I'll try to give a proper requiem for Frank Anderson. And we will hear from Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair, as a matter of fact, at the top of the show in their lead up to the Bash at the Beach 94, which is a decent enough show. Both that and the Clash of Champions in June of 94 are pretty easy watches. They don't, feel like they last forever, although as I'm watching Hell in a Cell right now as I tape this, and sometimes WWE shows these days, you feel like they run a little long. My strategy is I didn't turn it on until pretty much Strowman versus Roman Reigns started, and I'm a little puzzled as to why they built the Hell in the Cell entirely out of Twizzlers. I know I kind of stole that joke from the Place to Be Nation chat group, but as I'm looking at it for the first time, why is it all red? I don't quite understand it. Is it because you can't have real blood or anything these days, so we're just going to have red there? And I don't get it. After all, I'm just a guy who doesn't know who Puma King is. So with that in mind, why don't we just jump right into the show?
But also a very emotional one. Two former high school teammates, McClure and Hernandez, facing each other. Two RBIs by Hernandez.
For my sports moment of 1982, I didn't want to do another hockey one again, because that would be three in a row and would really be showing my own biases. Basketball, there really wasn't a whole heck of a lot, at least in the NBA. I guess I could have gone with Michael Jordan hitting the jumper against Georgetown to win the NCAA title, but he did that with like 18 seconds left in the game, and they had to come up with a ridiculous steal. I think it was Freddie Brown just threw the ball to a guy on North Carolina, and kind of a Chris Webber-esque mistake 11 years before that would happen. That play you just heard is Keith Hernandez, bases loaded with one out in the bottom of the sixth. The Milwaukee Brewers up in Game 7 of the World Series 3-1, gets a two-run single, tie the game. They then score another run in that inning and would go on to win 6-3. The pitcher there, Bob McClure. Hi, I'm Bob McClure. You might know me from such disasters as Game 7 of the 1982 World Series and being the pitching coach for the Bobby Valentine Red Sox in 2012. Yes, that is the same guy. The starting pitcher for the Brewers in that game was Pete Vukovic, who would go on to much greater fame playing Clue Hayward in the movie Major League, which I like how the guy who played the hitter, Clue Hayward, was a pitcher in real life, but the guy who played the pitcher, the Duke, who pitched the ninth inning of that playoff game between the Indians and the Yankees, was a catcher by the name of Steve Yeager. Kind of funny how that all works.
I hate Keith Hernandez. Hate him.
I despise him.
Newman and Kramer were mistaken in their hatred for Keith Hernandez, who these days is a rather beloved color commentator for Mets baseball on the SNY Network. And speaking of beloved color commentators, you got Jesse Ventura at the Open, and he has a completely shaved bald head. However, he's got the thing in the back like the monks from Airplane, where he has only the little hair in the back. Also Paul Kinsey from Mad Men, when he joins that weird cult around season 2 or 3, when he just kind of flips out and goes nuts and kind of loses his mind at his job, which I can certainly relate to. So seeing Jesse there and knowing that Hogan is on the scene, I'm really expecting some sort of biting sarcasm. But instead, Jesse kind of plays it straight, saying that it's interesting to see Hogan doing the chasing for a change, since he's usually the guy on top. So, yeah, you just wait, Jesse. Just give it a couple of weeks and things will change. And they flash back to the previous week's WCW Saturday Night, the famous Hogan press conference where he does the contract signing down at Disney and all that.
You see me be a champion as many times as I get fingers on my hand, brother. I body slammed Andre the Giant. God bless his soul, man. I beat all the best right in the center of the ring. And the one thing that I've always dreamed about, the one thing that I've always dreamed is to make not only Hulkamania, because Hulkamania, the training, the prayers, and the vitamins that's instilled in this generation, that's going to be immortal. But I want myself, Hulk Hogan, to go down as immortal. And the only way to become immortal in the WCW is to beat the man. And you all know, woo, to be the man, you gotta beat the man. So my goal in the WCW is to go all the way to the top, and when I get Ted Turner by his arm, we're gonna find out who the most powerful man in the WCW is. Because as I bend him down all the way to the table, Ted Turner someday will say, yes, Hulk Hogan, you've got the match with Ric Flair.
There are a couple of things I took out of that whole presser. One is that he goes back to the training, the prayers, and the vitamins as only 3 demandments of Hulkamania, when he had expanded it out to 5 with the 1990 edition of Believing in Yourself and the much forgotten 1993 edition of Believe in Hulk Hogan, which whatever. So okay, so he's trimmed that back to 3. He said that also he beat all the best. And anybody listening to this probably yelling at their iPod, or if you're crazy enough to yell at your listening device or whatever, like, no, you never beat Jerry Lawler. I'm thinking of that. And they did have a match in Memphis in February of 1981 that drew 9,000 to the Mid-South Coliseum. And the interesting thing about that is Hogan's still a heel at that point, and he actually had Jimmy Hart at his side, which made sense because Jimmy is the big heel manager in Memphis at the time. But now, okay, so you got Flair, and he's bringing up the name right away, and obviously that's going to be the first thing on everybody's mind when Hogan comes into Flair's territory. And Flair is kind of like an animal backed into a corner. So instead of, you know, the calm, reserved Flair promos, he's now a heel. He's not going to do the what is known as the Minnesota Rick that I believe Alan or Parv had talked about with his promo style. He is now a heel, and he's going to get a little bit unhinged in talking about Hogan invading his turf.
Who's Hulk Hogan, anyway? A movie star that beat up Stallone, slapped around Mr. T? Where are they? I'll do it right now. He's not the world champion yet. He's not even here today yet. But in your eyes, he's the immortal one. For Hogan, be at the Clash of Champions. Please be there to see what immortality and greatness is all about.
Well, I mean, if you put the kayfabe hat on for a second, one good turn deserves another, because when Flair comes into the WWF about 3 years before this, he comes in proclaiming himself the real world's champion. So it's only fair that Hogan kind of talk big when he come in and demand an immediate title match. Of course, WCW, this is one of the things, they're smart enough to actually put it on pay-per-view and get a good buy rate at Bash of the Beach, which I think was about 1.02. I might be mistaken. It might be 0.87, but I think the 8.7 is what Meltzer had said would justify the signing from a cost perspective. Apparently, he did all the financial analysis or whatever. But WWF decides, you know what, we're going to debut this at a house show in Dayton or Oakland or wherever it was, and we're just going to do double countout finishes around the horn so that anybody who, you know, is a big enough fan to go to the house show to see this will be like, okay, well, it's completely meaningless now. We've already used up the matchup, but okay. But Hogan's going to get the last word because he's got everything in his contract to dictate how things are going to go. And Jimmy Hart is with Hogan, which is always incredibly annoying to me because it takes a special kind of dude to make a babyface manager role work. There's very few instances in history where it actually has. I'm thinking Jim Cornette for that very brief period in 88 and into 89. And even that, a lot of it was because he had Paulie Dangerously to play off against. But fine, I guess Hogan wanted him front and center and didn't want him only working behind the scenes as his real-life manager, which is how they should have done it. But we get a return to the Hogan promos where, yes, he mentioned Ted Turner earlier, but it kind of makes sense because he owns WCW, although he seemed a little confused. Did he think that Ted Turner was actually booking the promotion? I mean, it's like, oh, Ted Turner is going to make the match. Like, no, I don't think Turner is actually carrying the pencil around these parts. Although, if Ted Turner had actually been made the booker when he got aced out of the time, you know, because of the AOL Time Warner merger and lost all of his power, that actually kind of would have been fun, and he probably would have been better than Vince Russo. But Hogan, you know, in his old WWF promos, his more famous ones, he just liked to mention people for kind of no reason. And this one is very much in that spirit.
Just the other day, as it all went down at the Clash of Champions, when I headed to my hotel room, the phone was ringing as I put the key in the door, brother. And on the other end of the phone was the number one Hulkamaniac of all time, Jane Fonda. Was phoning Hulk Hogan's room, brother. I thought maybe it was a 4 or 5 treadmills I've already put over 1,000,000 miles on getting ready for these matches at the WCW. But no. Jane Fonda said, Hulkster, me being the maniac I am and you having the power in the largest arms in the world, how could you just sit there and let this go by? Well, I told Jane Fonda I moved as quick as I could, but Slick Rick was already out of town, man. So that's my down card, you little mouse, Jimmy Hart. We're going to get a hold of Ted Turner by hook or by crook, even if we got to twist his necktie with Jane Fonda at the helm. But the way it goes right now, Ric Flair, I've got your number. Jane Fonda's on my side. Ted Turner, Ric Flair, what you going to do when Hulk Hogan runs wild on you?
A couple things I'm going to try to ignore from that. First is the WCW thing, like it's the Ohio State University or the George Washington University. It's one of those things that's been talked about a lot, but fine. Hogan is wearing what looks to be a scale size cross crucifix around his neck, much larger than the one that people remember from the Piper's Pit with Andre back in the day. It's probably about 15 times bigger than that. I don't know. I might be exaggerating that slightly, but Jane Fonda is the number one Hulkamaniac. That's got to be a bitter blow to Tugboat, that guy who would go to all the events, including Bash the Beach 94. You see him at Halloween Havoc 95, who would dress up like Hogan. He was also a King of the Ring 93, as I recall. How did she get to be the number one Hulkamaniac? Is this just some sort of appeal because she's married to Ted Turner at the time, married to him? In 91, they ended up getting divorced in 2001. They would be seen together at Braves games very often in the early 90s. But, okay, she's the number one Hulkamaniac of all people. I got to warn Hogan, okay? You better watch your back with Jane Fonda because it could be just a matter of time that she's posing for photos on Space Mountain or whatever because she's been caught doing that before.
Regulators. We regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too. But you can't be any geek off the street. Gotta be handy with the steal, if you know what I mean. Earn your keep.
Regulators!
I don't know what's funny is when you look up Warren G for a Google search and then it'll recommend words afterwards, you'd think that Warren G. Harding might come up first, given that he was a president of the United States, but In actuality, Warren G. Regulate actually comes up before that. And, you know, that song was number three at this week in 1994. There's some dudes driving around, getting into a little trouble, and then they smoke weed at the end of the song, which I'm sure we can all relate to. And particularly Brian Pillman, who is actually riding in a car to come to the aisle to walk to the ring for this match, because they're on, you know, a movie set lot, and I guess they're trying a number of different things. They called it the New York City set. They alluded to it here, you know, which they used to make it look like Manhattan or whatever. He is taking on The Shadow in this. Now, The Shadow is a guy who is under a mask, and I immediately want to know who this guy is. It is not the White Shadow, because it's definitely not Ken Howard, because he's far too tall, and it is not the Shadow who would be Pez Watley a couple of years later, because this is a white guy, but like I said, not the White Shadow. But The Shadow was the name of a movie that came out July 1st of 94, so not long after this. It starred Alec Baldwin, where he battles a villain who is building an atomic bomb. I have never seen that movie. It's a bit of a cult classic, or so it says. And on Rotten Tomatoes, I think it's in the 30s in terms of its rating. Grossed $48 million at the box office against a $40 million budget, which is not what you're looking for, even though it sounds like $8 million of profit. You got to go a little bit higher than that, because I think that there are other costs that are not accounted for. But our star here is Brian Pillman, and his 1994, he's kind of a little bit lost in the shuffle. And I picked up the book Crazy Like a Fox by Liam O'Rourke, and I'm glad that I did, because there is a lot of insight into Brian Pillman's life and career. I mean, as you would expect from any biography, but particularly a lot of the inside WCW stuff, particularly going into the Loose Cannon character, which is a much more well-thought-out character than even I had imagined. And almost kind of thought, okay, they developed this crazy character, and he was just going to do whatever he want. But he would read books on how to approach the psychology of it. So I recommend the book. Again, it's Crazy Like a Fox by Liam O'Rourke. When you look at Pillman in 1994. Yeah, you get the Hollywood Blondes breakup, as I alluded to earlier, in 93. And his contract is coming up for renewal in the very early spring of 94. And he's not entirely sure what he's going to do. He's reached out to Japan, to independent promotions, and of course the WWF. But that was a bad time to be a free agent and want to go to the WWF, because you got Vince McMahon under indictment. They're really just kind of circling the wagons and becoming a smaller company. And they're not offered, obviously, much of any guarantee as the WWF was doing at that time. So eventually, Eric Bischoff books him against Lord Steven Regal for Spring Stampede 94. And it looked like that match, according to the book, wasn't going to happen. But eventually, they had the match because Pillman had been signed right beforehand for what was effectively the same deal as he had before. So extend his contract out to 1996. It was a draw, that match against Regal. So he's not getting the television title or anything like that. But here we go from the book. At the pay-per-view, Pillman and Regal wrestled to a draw with WCW, not wanting to job out their fresh investment, but not wanting to give him the television title either. Talk again began to surface of turning Brian heel, this time to pair him with Sensuous Sherry, played by the former Sensational Sherry of WWF fame. They shot and aired a number of matches with Sherry scouting Pillman, referencing her desire to manage a new championship-level wrestler. And I'm going to leave it at that, because Sherry actually does turn up during the course of this match, which is kind of funny. And we start with hammerlocks aplenty into a roll-up for two. Not exactly, you know, the high-flying stuff from Pillman. You're not seeing so much of that here. And Sherry does walk out at that point, holding up a mask over her face. I don't know if she's trying to, you know, it's very clearly Sherry, Sensuous Sherry, which was kind of an easy get around for WCW. Just pick out another adjective that starts with S. Might be a good idea, you know, in the future, if you're looking to do that. S, there's a lot of adjectives you could go with. And as I said, she is scouting Pillman for a potential angle down the road. Now, what happened with this? Well, I'll continue the passage from the book. As per WCW form, the angle was dropped on a dime and never referred to again, once new booker Ric Flair decided he'd take Sherry as his own manager to help him with his upcoming heel turn. Flair was moving towards that side of the fence for seemingly good reason. Eric Bischoff had made an acquisition that would completely transform World Championship Wrestling. So I understand it from that perspective. But, you know, just taking it in the moment, maybe, okay, Sherry's going to manage other people at some point. So Tony Schiavone on commentary starts asking what I consider to be the wrong questions, because we already had Sherry paired with Flair at the Clash, but obviously this was taped before that, because this is a WCW worldwide taping in 1994. Who knows when it was actually done? It could have been in April for all we know. But Jesse's retort to Tony's questions lightens the mood a bit.
Wait a minute. She picked her man this past Thursday at the Clash of the Champions and picked Ric Flair. So what is she doing out here, scouting for the Unified World Champ?
Either that or she's going to pick her men, plural.
There she is. And
nobody ever said Sherry couldn't handle more than one guy.
Now, if this had happened today on Schiavone's podcast, I think things would have been a little bit different, because now we know from just listening to that Tony Schiavone, and I mean this in a very specific way, is the Bob Saget of the kind of wrestling internet, in that you thought of him as this clean-cut guy for a very long time, but really he's just kind of a filthy comic just looking to get out for whatever reason. So there's a little bit of awkward silence before Tony finally fires back.
I'm not going to even respond to that one. Sherry.
Wait a minute, Tony. All I'm stating to you is that plenty of managers have more than one player in their stable.
Drop it.
You drop it. You know what you're thinking about out here.
Stop wrist lock.
Tony really is a tremendous straight man to Jesse's kind of freewheeling style of commentary. And as I'm watching this, I say, oh God, even you get a regular Brian Pillman match, and the focus isn't even on him, because Sherry's on the outside and talking about that. As he works the arm of the Shadow, we get a We Want Flair chant, which is like the last thing you want to hear when you're in a WCW ring, whether you're main eventing the Great American Bash or you're on some worldwide taping in the spring of 94. You kind of want to get a little bit of shine there. Get some big slaps and chops that Pillman, of course, evoking Ric Flair, and he follows it up with a backdrop. And he finishes it off. Like I said, you don't see any really of the high-flying stuff from Pillman here. And I would suggest maybe that it's because what's the point of doing all that? You don't have to do a damn dive to the outside on a freaking worldwide taping. I mean, most of these people probably don't even watch the product on a regular basis, although they're very much into it. They are making a lot of noise, as you can tell from the sound clip. And I think that he's going for a high cross body off the top rope, but instead it kind of ends up like a clothesline, almost like he changed his mind at the last minute. There may have been a miscommunication. But for Brian Pillman in 1994, later in the year, he would end up in ECW for a very brief period. It was kind of interesting how Pillman ended up in ECW for this stretch. The more famous one is when he turns up in early 96 and says he's going to whip out his Johnson and piss in the ring and all that. But much earlier, he's actually taking the place of Steve Austin, who was supposed to go as part of an arrangement when they did the When Worlds Collide pay-per-view. Apparently, and this is according to Crazy Like a Fox, ECW had named one of their shows When Worlds Collide or something to that effect earlier in 94. So as compensation for them kind of dropping it, they asked for use of Austin, which ended up becoming Pillman, on one of their shows. And it's interesting to see that kind of cooperation. But 1994, I mean, this is a year where you get to October And Brian Pillman is jobbing to the Honky Tonk Man on three consecutive occasions on house shows. He doesn't turn up on any more pay-per-views after that spring stampede. So they sign him to that contract and immediately gets lost in the shuffle. Certainly, I think, a victim of Hogan coming in and kind of getting overrun eventually by all the cronies, because Pillman's this 230-pound guy who is perceived as small, and Hogan really has no interest in working with him, at least until March of 1996, which I'm sure I'll get into at some point. But Brian Pillman, sort of like Major League Baseball in that same year, it was really just kind of a lost year, and it'd be best if everybody just sort of forgot about it.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Go back to the interview area. We have Chris Cruz, which is giving me some nice flashbacks to some WCW Prime shows, which I'm not finding too many of online. For whatever reason, they seem to be wiped out. I do have a few in my strategic reserve for the future. It'll probably be a while before I go back to that, because I kind of went nuts on WCW Prime. I think I did three of them in a really short time. He is with the television champion, but it's not Lord Steven Regal, even though he had won it at the Clash of the Champions 2 days before this, because clearly long-term booking was not in the cards at this time. So holding the television championship is Larry Zbyszko, who had won it from Lord Steven Regal earlier than that. See, WCW is not just about Freebirds, negative title reigns, stuff like that. It's also about having promos and then airing them after they had lost the belt. Like, little mistakes like that, but okay, I'm willing to accept it as we get an episode of According to Larry. But seeing Larry Z as a babyface, which is the first time here in 94. Yeah, he had been kicked out of the Dangerous Alliance in 92 after screwing up the War Games match for them, which, I don't know, as I watched that match, I always found that kind of mild, and they were looking for an excuse to get rid of him. It's kind of like Larry Z was being scapegoated the same way Bill Buckner was after the 1986 World Series. Not entirely his fault. There was a lot of different things that you could point to, but it's not exactly Hulk Hogan. Larry Z as a babyface isn't exactly Hulk Hogan in 1996 as a heel. However, it does change the dynamics slightly of According to Larry, which is so named because of Larry Zbyszko reminding me in many ways of Jim Belushi. And Jim Belushi starred in the 2000s in the show According to Jim. So I have dubbed a lot of these Larry interviews According to Larry. So let's see how things change with Larry as a babyface.
But you know what? We've got one thing in America here called freedom of speech, which means I've been called a lot of things over the years. We can't talk about it on TV, but one thing I've never been called, and that's a coward. You know, Lord Regal, this English nobleman, came out and he badmouthed me, and he badmouthed America, and he went on and on. He asked for it. You know, I really didn't want to get back in the ring, Chris. You know, I'm living happily ever after in Larry Land. I've got a 3 handicap. I've challenged them all from Greg Norman to Nick Faldo, and they flee in terror. You know, but now here I am, the television champion.
Larry, freedom of speech doesn't apply to what you yell at a wrestling event. The First Amendment refers to government not being allowed to restrict kinds of speech. You know, read the First Amendment, Larry. I'll even provide you with a copy of the Constitution. And also, a 3 handicap is really good, but I don't think they'd be fleeing in terror Nick Faldo. Like, this has to be like the only Nick Faldo reference ever made on a wrestling show, but okay. They were not fleeing in terror. They were like, ugh, get me away from this wrestling guy who won't shut up and won't stop talking about Bruno Sammartino. But at least he didn't talk about, at least he really didn't talk about Bruno here. And that's good. We've made a little bit of progress now, 14 years later. And Larry also weighs in with a little bit of a life lesson.
We come in this world alone and we leave alone, and the only thing that matters is what we do in between.
The more you know, Larry Zbyszko. Wow, he's really shown some growth over the last couple of years. Jesus, I love the WCW Worldwide theme at the top of the show. I mean, it was my ringtone for about a year until I got a little bit sick of it because I was getting a lot of work calls on that phone and I just needed to change it just to change the psychology of it. But boy, don't sleep on those bumpers. Those bumpers are really, really good. For our next bout, we have the United States champion, stunning Steve Austin, with his entourage of Colonel Robert Parker and Meng. And Austin, he just never looks right with hair. He still has the blonde hair parted to the side, and it just always looks wrong. I mean, give it up, Steve. I know you like having the blonde hair and all, but thank God that eventually he would just shave it. He is facing off against Kenny Kendall, who I looked up his cage matches. I am often interested in the enhancement talents, and he had a record in 1994 of 1-20, which made me wonder, is this the one? Does he get a cheap count-out win or anything? But no, this is not a taping that I could find records of anywhere other than, I think it's like WWFoldschool.com. I forget the exact website that lists the results of all the various worldwide shows from, you know, when they aired. So this June 25th show, it kind of gave at least the rundown of the matchups. Here's a question about Austin, because he re-signed at around the same time as Pillman. Pillman re-signed for the same money, but Austin got a bit of a raise. He becomes the U.S. champion for at least a while. Do you think Hulk Hogan, when he comes in, do you think he now looks back and wishes, maybe I should have built up this Steve Austin guy as a heel, even keeping him as stunning Steve Austin, just to the point where Hogan could then face him and get a win on him? Because you know it probably eats away at Hulk Hogan knowing that he went his entire career, they crossed paths in 2002, WWF. They don't have a match at WrestleMania 18 because neither guy at that point, frankly, would agree to lose to the other. Don't you think if Hogan had faced Steve Austin, say, in late 1994 or 1995, hell, even make Austin Starcade opponent instead of the Butcher? I mean, anything would have been better. Hell, make Kenny Kendall Hogan's opponent at Starcade. I think that might have been okay at the end of the day. In terms of watching all of this, I'm starting to get past how weird it feels, at least for me, to see Austin wrestling with Colonel Robert Parker as his manager. It feels slightly off because the Austin of WCW that I remember more is the 91 to 93, sort of 94 and 95. Even though he's the United States champion, I just kind of forget about that after a while. Jesse defends Parker and Meng being there at ringside. Tony had made some charges of how they were going to just interfere in everything, but Jesse puts up an impassioned defense.
Wait a minute. Number one, I don't recall, to the best of my knowledge, the Colonel ever jumping into the ring. Number two, I have yet to see Meng do anything violent.
Well, to be fair to Jesse, when he was in the WWF, he didn't really travel with the boys or anything like that. So I guess he wouldn't be privy to certain things that Haku, as he was known then, would have done in a hotel in Baltimore or whatever. Fine. And also, internet lore wasn't quite what it was in 1994. Yes, the internet existed, but you couldn't get these the Haku Meng urban legend hadn't quite taken off yet, but it should have still at least been well known among the boys. But again, Jesse was a little bit separate after a while. I mean, by the time King Tonga comes into WWF, you know, and kind of makes his name in 1986. Yeah, he was in 85, but he was teaming with Dino Bravo for a while. I mean, come on, what the hell is that going to get him? By the time he actually makes his name, Jesse is so separated from everything else, he never hears about this Haku Meng stuff. Once again, this crowd is really, really good, and this is something that they couldn't necessarily prompt. Well, maybe they could prompt it if they used monitors to chant a specific thing, and it took me a while to figure out what they were chanting at Colonel Robert Parker, and it is a KFC chant at him because of his resemblance in dress to Colonel Sanders. It's kind of curious, a Kentucky Fried Chicken. When did they just adopt the KFC name, which they did, I think, to kind of distance themselves from the term fried chicken because of, you know, it's not being the healthiest thing in the world. Apparently, it was 1991 when they got rid of the full name and just went with KFC. Austin, to my mind, is a bit too much of a Weasley sniveling heel here. I think there's a limit to where this character could have gone. I'm not saying that, you know, they shouldn't have pushed him further, but I think he should have evolved it, because in a match with Kenny Kendall, and by the way, I do enjoy this, that he complains audibly about Kenny Kendall. When he does a sunset flip, he complains about having his tights grabbed.
This young man has got me by the trunks.
No!
Oh, there you heard it. Stunning Steve complaining about Kenny Kendall pulling the tights.
Can't say I don't enjoy it, especially how well mic'd it was, as if Austin knew exactly where he should speak to so he should be heard properly. See, sometimes WCW guys would talk, and then they were talking to the camera, but you couldn't hear what they were saying because they weren't mic'd properly or they didn't know where the microphone was. But Austin, it's clear that he definitely knows what he's doing. And he does fire up. A very interesting move by Austin that I don't think I've ever seen him use before. And they don't name it because I don't think they know what to call it, Tony and Jesse. An inverted gut-wrench suplex is how I can probably best describe it. This is after he had made more complaints about Kendall grabbing the tights, and then he had fired up. He's moving rather fast in this match. I'm not saying he's like Rob Van Dam going boom, 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 or Sabu or anything like that, but for a Steve Austin match, I think it's going rather quickly. Jesse, because they're not going to talk about Steve Austin this entire time, and a lot of the focus of the promotion is on Flair and Hogan. Jesse is very excited about this, because don't forget, Jesse wasn't there in 91 and 92 when Flair and Hogan finally met in the WWF.
Imagine it, Tony. I think I'll be broadcasting it if it happens.
Wow, I think so.
I hope they sign it.
Oh, man.
Hulk makes money, Flair makes money, Jesse makes money. And Jesse don't even have to sweat.
Yeah, boy.
Jesse would, in fact, not end up calling that match because they were doing the weird thing in 94 where Jesse would call some of the matches and Bobby Heenan would call some of the matches, and it just seemed kind of random how it would be decided. But it does make me think, what is more enjoyable, Jesse Ventura calling a Hulk Hogan match or Bobby Heenan calling a Ric Flair match? I feel like there's different levels of enjoyment to it, with Ventura doing the needling of Hogan or Heenan doing the cheerleading of Flair. It's kind of interesting when you think about it. I think, obviously, Royal Rumble 92 is the top one that everybody thinks about for the Heenan-Flair side. But on Jesse and Hogan, there's a lot to choose from as well. I'd have to go with WrestleMania 5, where Jesse kept calling him the Luster during a match against Randy Savage in the main event in that one. Austin does finish this match off. And again, another move I don't remember him doing with great frequency. It was a Hollywood and Vine toe hold or leg lock. And I'm like, Hollywood and Vine, I guess he was calling it the Hollywood Vine as the name of the move, but I'm thinking more of the tag team from GLOW, Hollywood and Vine. So maybe Austin did this as some sort of tribute to GLOW. I don't know, probably not. But it's interesting, you never saw him break that out in the WWF. I feel like WrestleMania 13, not that that match with Bret Hart, the submission match, needed anything else. And, you know, he did have the million-dollar dream in his arsenal because of him being paired with DiBiase. But kind of interesting that you never really saw him bust that move out later on.
History was made this past Thursday night at the Clash of Champions when Flair defeated the international champ to become the unified champ. But for how long? That's the question. The Bash at the Beach is only 3 weeks away on Sunday, July the 17th at 7 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time.
Sorry, I know that the Yacht Rock channel is going away off Sirius XM soon, so I'm only going to hear that song probably on the Bridge channel and maybe the 70s channel in the future. So that they Bash at the Beach Control Center. Just a quick review of the Flair Sting thing. They don't show any highlights or anything like that, and they run down some of the matches for the Bash at the Beach show coming up on July 17th. Steve Austin is going to defend the U.S. title against Ricky Steamboat, and that would be a rivalry right up to the end of Steamboat's career, which would culminate at the Clash in August. Although on Cage Match, it lists four house show matches after the Clash. It's always my understanding that Steamboat's career-ending injury, or at least until the 2009 run, took place at that Clash. I don't know if he just decided to wrestle or if that's like kind of a false result or whatever. They also announced tag team title on the line, Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan against Pretty Wonderful. We're going to hear from Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan later, and Pretty Wonderful is in the feature bout on this episode of Worldwide. And then a tag match with Dustin Rhodes, who had asked Arn Anderson to be at his side, which given the issues with, I mean, let's think about this, Dustin. You could ask anybody in WCW to do this. And I know Arn Anderson is a big star, but this is a guy who broke your dad's leg 8 or 9 years before this. I'd still maybe hold a little bit of a grudge on that, especially since you were definitely old enough to remember all that going down. I know the kayfabe hat is on here. So out of everybody, he's the only guy available. Maybe it was just kind of the best available guy that he could have gotten, and he's just going to take his chances. He's facing Terry Funk and Buckhouse Buck from the Colonel Robert Parker stable, and they get a promo, and I posted a screenshot of this promo on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod the other day, and it is Colonel Parker, Buckhouse Buck, Terry Funk, who is barely saying anything during it, and Meng, who is just kind of lurking in the background of that. And I just wrote, I would not mess with these guys under any circumstances. But we do hear from the other side, Arn and Dustin. And Arn is going to do the majority of the talking because he is, even though he was the one who was invited in, he is the senior member of the team. And because it's an Arn Anderson promo, I'm going to play it.
You know, Terry Funk, they say if you can bluff a man, half the fight's won. Well, you're real good at that. You want to intimidate Dustin about his family? It don't work. You want to bring Buck out here, use him to play off of? You got the Colonel and Ming standing by? Let me explain something to you. I was brought in for a reason, and that reason will manifest itself in your face.
This is Unity, Funk and Buck, the enforcer and the natural Dustin Rhodes. And whatever you got, it ain't got enough. You better bring just a little bit more to the Bash.
Maybe I'm just projecting with Arn's words, but it's going to manifest itself. I was brought in, and it'll manifest itself for whatever reason. Come on, does it sound like the words of a walk-behinder, referencing Dusty Rhodes' famous promo at the upcoming Clash of the Champions in August, which would lead into the War Games at Fall Brawl? I do think that turn was very well done by Arn on Dustin, and it made sense because you've just turned Flair heel, and you kind of always want to have Arn Anderson on the same side as Ric Flair, except for that little brief period in 95 where you're going to put them against each other, and even that is only for the briefest of periods. But people often talk about how dumb Sting was in terms of trusting, especially Ric Flair, but, you know, not to turn on him, Halloween Havoc 95 being a prominent example. But there are other ones, such as when Sting was a horseman for about 23 minutes or however long it was. It wasn't long. Arn Anderson, of course, is there for that, too. But Dustin Rhodes, don't sleep on him being kind of an idiot, too, because, as I said, he just decides to 100% trust Arn Anderson and completely throw away everything that had happened in the past.
Please for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and at HistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Earlier in the show, I had mentioned WCW short-timer Frank Anderson, who actually makes an appearance on this show, but recently passed away at the age of 62 on September 9th, so only a few weeks ago. So my thought is, since Lance Storm won't properly eulogize him with one of his patented tweets of, "I didn't know the guy, he was in WCW long before me, and he left before me, but rest in peace," you know, that sort of stuff, I want to give this guy a little bit more of a proper requiem. He was an amateur wrestler out of Sweden who got a bronze medal at the 84 Olympics. And the thing that actually stuck out to me the most about his bio was, as a young man in Sweden during the late 70s, there was a song written about him called Frank's Disco, which basically just was sort of disco music that was played over some interviews of him in the Swedish language. And you bet your ass that I am going to play that song underneath what I'm going to consider my eulogy slash requiem for the great Frank Anderson. Because when am I going to talk about him again? Not sure if that's a tribute to Aha or anything, because they're Norwegian and not Swedish. Alright, this starts off well enough. I am watching the video on YouTube. It's labeled Frank Anderson, Frank, in quotation marks. It should be relatively easy to find if you just do that. Let me just read off a few of his accomplishments. He won a bronze medal at the 84 Olympics, in Los Angeles, in the 90 kilogram division, or 198 pound division for us normal people who go by normal non-metric weights. There he is. Oh, there he is. He's posing on a car in this little video that somebody on YouTube has put together. I don't think it's the official video. Fun fact about Frank Anderson: he debuted on the May 3rd, 1991 AWA show, which is considered to be the last AWA show ever. And oh my God, on this video, it shows him in a locker room, completely naked, but basically just covering up his toad, or his penis, with a towel. And it is an extremely close call here. I mean, you could probably see shadow of backsack or something like that. This is very unnerving. Okay, fine. They cut away to him drinking some milk. And if I could find anything notable that he did in WCW, I'll tell you about it. But really, there was not much that he did. It said that he had a kind of unsuccessful career. They show him in his wrestling singlet, and we're going to notice that during this match because he wears the amateur wrestling gear. and it's very noticeable, his package. I don't know if he was packing down there like John Hamm or what was going on, but the guy was clearly very proud of his toad, which is the new word this week for penis. I don't know what was going on with this video, but just take 2 minutes of your life to check it out. I mean, it is so bizarre. I mean, the thing with the towel and Frank Anderson, very reminiscent of that famous picture from Edmonton back in the day. It had to have, maybe it was in Los Angeles, I'm not sure, but it was the Edmonton Oilers locker room with Gary Coleman, Mark Messier, with Mark Messier drinking one of those little stubby bottles of beer, and his crotch barely covered by this towel. He was basically using either like a loincloth or like one of the things you would use to like dry your hands after you wash your hands in your house, something like that. And Anderson, he does a lot of amateur wrestling at the start. He was trained, it says, by Brad Rangins and the WCW Power Plant, which is an interesting combination of things. I guess one of them was for his AWA time, and then he started in WCW. They actually make reference to this being his first match, but he apparently did some shots on WCW's European tour. He rides Thor on the mat. Jesse refers to his apparel. I had come up with the idea that maybe Frank should have called himself the Total Package, since he's very fond of showing it off, and Lex Luger is in the other promotion, and the whole gimmick is up for grabs. He does pick the guy up in a fireman's carry rollover slam for two, which was pretty impressive, and then Thor gets a little bit of offense. He gets whipped hard to the corner. Anderson hits his back hard, but he recovers quickly with a drop kick and then follows with a monkey flip. And a pretty crisp Northern Lights suplex finishes. He's not a bad wrestler by any means. Maybe not the greatest pro wrestler, because the charisma is not necessarily there. He's certainly more Brad Rangins than, let's say, Kurt Angle. But I'm sorry, I can't take this dude seriously with the way he is presenting his package and after viewing that video.
Gentlemen, we gather here today on a very solemn occasion. This young man who has traveled the great distance, who has spent many weeks of hard training with us, who has become like our own brother, must now also be sworn in. He's learned the kind of respect and discipline that will serve us proud. So repeat after me. I, Ray Traylor.
I, Ray Traylor.
Do hereby swear.
Do hereby swear.
That I will honor and respect.
That I will honor and respect.
The mission of a true guardian angel.
The mission of a true guardian angel.
You knew things had gotten weird with Ray Traylor if they have to actually do an oath and swear him into a new gimmick after they had tried the boss in WCW, and then he had been stripped of that, and they came up with this guardian angel thing where he would actually join the group that had several chapters around the United States. Curtis Sliwa is the guy. He's a kind of radio personality in New York, and he had the chapter up in Boston made a little noise, I remember, back in 2007. And I'm never going to be able to talk about the Guardian Angels probably ever again. But this is kind of an interesting story in that when they came up here, there was a bit of controversy because nobody was sure who all these guys were, who were the Guardian Angels. And as it turned out, I actually knew one of the guys who had put himself front and center, and he had been in the newspaper, and somebody saw it, and it came out that years before he had been convicted of a sex crime against a kid, which surprised the hell out of me, because this is the same guy who actually worked at Bruins games. I think he worked in like concessions management or whatever, and he would get a friend of mine a coffee during every game. He would like bring it to him as kind of like a friendly gesture. So that was kind of shocking to hear, you know, just kind of an innocuous guy who you see, you know, at, you know, hockey games that I go to 30, 40 times a year, and all of a sudden he turns out to be this like level 3 sex offender who's on the front page of the Boston Herald. It's like you never know what tomorrow is going to bring. The Guardian Angels, they would wear these red satin jackets. but I think it's kind of counteracted by the ratty looking white t-shirt with the red lettering they would have that Ray Traylor, as the Guardian Angel, would actually wrestle in. And all I can think is, when the Boss Man, when he was the Boss Man, that is, and he had that outfit, all you can remember is that shirt coming apart in the front, the big Boss Man outfit, and the giant, pie-sized pit stains under his arms. So he's going to go through white shirts to beat the band, because it's going to turn yellow in a hurry unless you get, like, that special deodorant that is supposed to counteract that, which I'm not sure works. And anyway, I don't get any of this, because you had the Big Bubba Rogers gimmick just sitting right there that was perfectly fine in the 80s, in the same place, in Jim Crockett Promotions, that is. You couldn't have just used that? I mean, you could have brought out some, you know, similar personalities, but it is a completely, you know, distinct gimmick to it. He's taking on Brian Costello here, and such as is my commitment to research for this show, Costello is a guy who did a lot of enhancement work in the WWF in the late 80s and into the early 90s, and as it turns out, he and the Big Boss Man never met in the WWF, so this is a long-awaited matchup between Ray Traylor and Brian Costello, and it looks like Traylor had put on a bunch of weight, especially when you think of the 90, 91, even into 92 Boss Man. He's noticeably thicker. However, he did do the quick run and slide to the outside where he then popped Costello with a quick uppercut. And then back inside, he winds up and hits Costello with a bolo punch, which really, Jesse Ventura really kind of marked out for that one, and then follows up with the Irish Whip and the Boss Man or Guardian Angel Slam or Sidewalk Slam, whatever you want to call it. However, after the match, he does the thing, Guardian Angel, where he goes to the corner and wants to talk into the camera, you know, cut a little promo. But because this is WCW, we're not going to show that. We're going to be at a completely different camera where you can't even actually hear any of what he's saying. So, such as it was for Ray Traylor in WCW, just kind of floating from one thing to another. Yes, he would eventually become Big Bubba Rogers again, main eventing the first Nitro against Hulk Hogan in place of Vader, because of Vader having the issue with Paul Orndorff in the shower that time. It just seems that WCW forgot that there was more to Ray Traylor than just being some sort of prison guard / law enforcement authority. For a long time, I thought that in this song, Mr. Jones by Counting Crows, that the lead singer Adam Duritz was talking about his own penis, that his penis was representative of Mr. Jones. But, you know, I'm sorry. We didn't have pop-up video back then, and I apologize for all the cock talk on this show. I guess that story earlier this week with Trump is just really kind of done me in, and now it's just filling my brain with nonsense. But right now, we have a promo with Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan, although Cactus doesn't get to speak very humorously because Kevin Sullivan, who is a babyface here, yes, he was a babyface for much of the 1970s, but when you say Kevin Sullivan, you think devil worshiper, you think this is a man who booked his own divorce, as it was said in 96 and into 97 as he was wrapping up his in-ring career in WCW. But seeing him as a babyface is certainly kind of interesting, you know, within the context of all of that. And Gene Okerlund asks Sullivan a little bit about Hulk Hogan, which is interesting because they would have that feud with Sullivan, a member of the Dungeon of Doom, that felt like it went on and on and on and on. But then Sullivan delights me here by just going off into other stuff and just doing some great pure, because he is from the area. And he's not like one of my friends who the accent only comes out when he has three or four drinks. This, he's going to let his freak flag fly.
This should be the happiest day of my life. This is the biggest event in the history of wrestling. It's finally happened. The man is meeting the immortal. But it isn't. My brother Dave was jumped by two people. One of them Orndorff, a man that put the sport where it is today, and the other one, Paul Roemer, a man that I thought was going to be the biggest star in the sports today. Something got to them. Maybe they thought they deserved the title shot. And I heard Arn Anderson talking about violence and how he was so violent. Arn Anderson, I don't care how violent you think you are. Take a look at this man and take a look at me. And Orndorff, Roemer, I'm going to tell you a little story. When I was a kid, I was never right. They used to send me to the junkyard to get rats. And I used to have this big stick. And I used to go and get these big rats. And I would corner those rats in the back of the junkyard. And I would take that spike. And I'd stab those little rats. And I'll jump at Roma. It ain't gonna be pretty. I know this two rats.
Fucking rat anyways. Whole family's all rats. Would have grown up to be a rat.
Wondering where Kevin Sullivan saw all these rats. Maybe it was in Charlestown or South Boston, or maybe even in the Boston Garden of his youth in the 60s and 70s, because there was plenty of those in there. Only made me think of the rat at the end of The Departed walking across the balcony, where it should have just had a giant symbolism thing. It's kind of rammed down our throats. So instead, I'm going to play the clip from Goodfellas, because that made more sense anyway. Now, I had mentioned that Cactus Jack, poor guy, he's kind of on his way out in WCW anyway, even though he's a tag team champion. Poor guy doesn't even get to talk, but Gene gently breaks the news to him.
Cactus, I'm sorry, we're out of time. What can be said after that? Stay tuned, we're back after this.
Those damn bumpers from WCW Worldwide are so great. I wish there was like a score album of the WCW C and D shows that I could just purchase. I was actually looking for the score of The Goonies recently, because apparently they made like either like 100 or 1,000 copies, and it was very limited. Consequently, it's like $200 to buy that score. It's like, yeah, no thank you. I want no part of that. And Pretty Wonderful, who was the opponent for Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan at Bash of the Beach, where they would win the World Tag Team titles. They are warming up for that by facing the Armstrong brothers. Now, you might be wondering, which Armstrongs are there? Is it Steve and Brad? Is it Brian? Who is it? Scott? Is he in there? No, in this case, it is actually Brad Armstrong, who you would expect in this spot, and Brian Armstrong. Yes, the road dog in a WCW ring, not long before he would turn up in the WWF as the roadie. I think that's about 6 months away from when this originally aired. I do question how the Armstrongs, though, would constantly wear their University of Georgia jackets to the ring. I'm not sure if it was University of Georgia per se, but it's a red jacket and it says Georgia on it, so I'm kind of extrapolating it from that. But you're taping these in Orlando, Florida, and Florida State, any place down there would be a rival of Georgia, and these guys are supposed to be baby faces. But okay, it's, you know, maybe it's a different time, I don't know. You get the little applause thing telling the crowd to cheer, although, like I said, this audience for this particular show just seems really amped up for whatever reason. Jesse, though, is very clever, and he notices something different about their gear.
The Armstrong!
And look at on their boots. They both got Bachelor of Arts degrees.
No.
I don't know why I like that gag so much. Maybe it's because for years, because I majored in journalism at Boston University, I've often said that I got my Bachelor of Science, or my BS, in BS. One good thing about teaming Roma with Orndorff is you can maintain the Paula chants that have been plaguing Orndorff for a decade, at least when he was a heel, because it now works double because both guys are named Paul. I know that sort of thing probably wouldn't fly in the WWF, where a lot of people have had to give up their first name in more recent years. And in terms of two guys who tag together with the same first name is a little bit unusual. On the other side, Brian Armstrong, I remembered him as being in the military, and I was like, oh, please don't tell me he didn't go the route of Randy Orton and went like AWOL and had all sorts of weird things happen. But no, he served in Desert Storm in the United States Marine Corps, which Tony actually brings it up during this match, because it's a good thing to bring up for a baby face like that. And it's funny because he would serve in two different branches of the military. Of course, the Marines and the DX Army later on. Well, they can't all be home runs. Orndorff is arguing very demonstratively with Nick Patrick before the match. Nick Patrick and his Alice from the Brady Bunch hairdo. Why does he have that hair? Like, what makes him look in a mirror and say, you know, this is a look that looks good on me? What made him decide that? I don't really think much of him as a referee, and that's, you know, excluding the Starrcade 97 screw-up for all the legend and commentary surrounding that. His hair just annoys the hell out of me. It's like, stop it. He's like the only referee I ever wanted to lose a hair match between two guys. And I want the referee to get his head shaved. That would be much better. Brad Armstrong, he ends up getting the early edge, shoulder block, and a drop toe hold on Orndorff, and then starts working the left arm, which makes me wonder, with Orndorff having one arm that is much smaller than the other, which one would you work on? Would you work on the smaller one to really weaken it, or do you work on the bigger one in order to bring it to par? I think you would want to bring it to par and work on the bigger arm so you can kind of weaken both, because you know he's kind of disabled in one of them anyway. Brian gets in. This is where they mention Desert Storm. And Roma tags in, but he gets caught as well, and they work his left arm for a little bit. Almost feel like they could have skipped over the Orndorff segment, but then again, it would have, you know, prevented me from asking those kind of questions. Brad misses on a running crossbody as Roma ducks out of the way, and that is our transition in this match. And then Jesse says something rather fascinating about Paul Roma's physique.
You know, Paul Roma's amazing. Look at the build on this guy. This guy can eat pizza every night.
But Jesse, if he started eating pizza every night, he would lose that physique in a hurry. It doesn't matter what kind of pizza you eat. And then when he said that, it kind of put my mind off track, and I just started making notes about pizza. Like, should I get a pizza? Should I go to Roma Pizza, which is in Lowell, just down Route 38 across from the Dunkin' Donuts? Trust me, it's there, and it is actually across the street from Dunkin' Donuts, and it's next to a liquor store that's a pretty good liquor store, except they're completely disorganized. You probably have seen something like this where they have a lot of stuff, but like they don't put the IPAs together, so they don't bunch it by, you know, type. And they don't put, like, the various brands together. It's just kind of a complete free-for-all in there and completely disorganized. But they generally have Anchor Christmas Ale. But as for pizza, I want to say some favorite pizza toppings of mine. Meatball is, when it's done well, is the best pizza topping there is. I'm thinking meatball with, like, some ricotta cheese. You can do a lot of different things with it, and you could do it as like a meat lover's, but I prefer to keep it to three toppings max because you don't want to get anything lost in the shuffle. Pepper and onion, maybe with a little Italian sausage, but what you want to do with your peppers and onions is you want to cook them down a little bit before you put it on the pizza so that it's not weighing it down. You don't want them to be all crisp and anything. You know, cook them down a little, maybe put a little olive oil in there. But I'm also very fond, and when my wife travels for work, I'm usually here by myself for a full Monday to Friday week, and usually one of those nights, I will make an arugula pizza, thinking, well, you know, arugula, I'm going to eat it in a salad anyway, and you can put it on the pizza, and it's very good as a topping, and of course, it is healthy, and when you cook it down, it kind of flattens onto the pie, so that's my cooking recommendation. I have not done many of those on this show, but yeah, Jesse, just talking about pizza just really threw me off track. And then Orndorff does that move where in the mid-90s in WCW, he started doing the shimmying hully-gully type thing where he would then drop a forearm. And it all of a sudden hit me that this is where the Road Dogg got that exact same move that he would do in every match in 98, 99, and 2000, New Age Outlaws and singles matches, stuff like that. He saw Paul Orndorff do this move from the apron and said, you know what? If I ever become famous somewhere else, I'm going to do that move. And with Orndorff well retired by 98, it was something that he could definitely just kind of steal, and, you know, what's anybody going to do about it? Sunset flip hope spot, but these close enough to the ropes, Orndorff is to tag Roma, who then hits a standing dropkick, which is a move that, of course, I always enjoy. He then cheap shots Brian to distract the referee because Brian now wants to charge into the ring. And Brad ends up blocking a head to the turnbuckle and rams Roma instead, and he tags out, double tag actually, Brian Armstrong and Paul Orndorffer. And Brian has some good fire here, but it leads to a very interesting finish to this match, because I had often talked about the Powerplex, Roma's team from WWF with Hercules, Power and Glory, and how that's never really gotten used by anybody else to the best of my recollection. However, here, they do something very close to it, where there's a bit of a melee, everything breaks down, all four in the ring, referee is a little bit distracted. Brian is going for a suplex, but he gets spun around, and Orndorffer gets the vertical suplex. But instead of just letting go as they go to the mat, he kind of keeps the headlock on to keep Brian on the mat. And Roma, seeing that Brad is being distracted by the referee, runs down the apron, a la the old Powerplex move, and hits a splash off the top rope. And that picks up the 1-2-3 on Brian Armstrong, Paul Roma, and Paul Orndorffer picking up the win here. So I'm calling this a toned-down Powerplex because it was a regular vertical suplex, so I'm dubbing this the Power Saver Plex. Oh, cut the crap. I'm going to have to fire my sound effects guy, I think. Fun match. And these Armstrongs, no matter who they are, what combination, they did tend to put on a pretty good show for a 5 to 10 minute TV match. At the beginning of the show, we got to hear from Hulk Hogan with a rebuttal from Ric Flair and then another rebuttal by Hulk Hogan. So it is only fair to Flair to go to what I'll call the bottom of the second inning, where Flair is allowed to give a closing promo to this show. And he is with Gene Okerlund and Sensational Sherry. And Okerlund is most certainly sneaking a peek down at Sherry's cleavage, which I'm sure Sherry knows to expect, having worked with the guy in the WWF. And I look at Sherry with Flair and I think, wow, she would have been a really good fit to be with Ric Flair in 1991 WWF when he had come in. Of course, she was managing Ted DiBiase at that time, which of all the people she managed in the WWF, that was certainly the strangest fit. Although, from the perspective of, oh, well, she was only in it for his money as sort of a transitional thing, it made sense from that perspective. And it was better, I guess, to give Mr. Perfect something to do with him being injured. And I have no issues with him being the executive consultant after Heenan really couldn't hack it on the road with Ric Flair. So here is the closer, Ric Flair. And he says that Sherry is his insurance policy going forward, because they had only joined up officially 2 days before at the Clash of the Champions.
All I can remember is the music blaring, Hogan tearing off his t-shirt, but everybody in the building saying, Ric Flair is the new unified champion against all odds. That's what you call insurance. It's outsmart them. It's bringing the best ball players to the game. It's making sure that the deck is stacked. It's making sure that when you walk that aisle and you style and profile, that you walk out in victory lane. It means you buy new suits and nice ties. You ride long limousines. And it means, most of all, that at the Bash at the Beach, Hulk Hogan, oh, the immortal one, wow, show me immortality, bring it to me, make it reality, because in Orlando, Hogan, you're on the dotted line, it's ready to go, you and me. Ask the sensuous one what she thinks.
Sensuous Sherry, what do you got up your sleeve?
Hulk Hogan, let me tell you something. What I did, this thing is going to be nothing. And I mean nothing compared to what I'm going to do to you. And immortality, brother, this man is walking immortality.
Orlando, we're coming. Woo!
thing that kind of separates what Flair's doing here from the old Techwood Studios promo is, yeah, he's saying he's coming to Orlando, but he's not indicating what hotel he's going to be in, what room he's going to be in, you know, for all the ladies to come down and see him. Because don't forget, it's only 6 months before this that he's doing vignettes during Starrcade where he's leaving his house, where his entire family is. So, you know, he's going to ease his way back into that scene, I think. And they run down the next week's episode of Worldwide, which would feature the debut of a tag team, Stars and Stripes, the Patriot and Marcus Alexander Bagwell, and also another Brian Pillman appearance on the next week's Worldwide. So he's not appearing on pay-per-views or super shows anymore, but we're going to throw him out there on Worldwide every freaking week. And that closes for this episode of Worldwide for June 25th, 1994. And you bet your ass they have a great closing song. It's a shame that a company goes out of business when they have music that good on their program. Sure, they probably changed it before the end, but maybe I should just flip out at Vince Russo and make that like my life's mission to just sort of harass that guy. Oh, wait, that's Jim Cornette's gimmick. Never mind. Just a few pieces of business before I go. I can't really name a beer of the week because I had so many of them in what was a surprisingly robust New Mexico beer scene. There were a lot of different breweries down there, a lot of different tap rooms to go into. One of them is called Chili Line Brewing that specializes in smoked beers. And usually I don't care much for that style, but on that day I was actually in the mood for it. They had smoked Hefeweizen. They had smoked versions of really any kind of beer you could find. But for my beer of the week, I'm going to name Santa Fe Brewing's 7K IPA, which is, you know, kind of a plain pick for me anyway. But in going to what they call the Santa Fe break room, which it's a history of that I'm not going to get into. But I went there on one of the afternoons, I think a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And these two women come in with this, well, this one guy comes in and he knows one of the two women. And then he starts hitting on the other woman who he doesn't know. And he starts going into his pickup routine, which includes talking about how his previous two wives are deceased, which is a little weird. And then he starts talking about all these various other problems. And I'm thinking that with my wife, that maybe we should get out of there because we might end up being witness to something later on. Like we might be called to testify when something inevitably happens to this poor woman if they were to end up together or whatever. At one point, the dude is like, oh, my skin, it's so dry. And I texted my wife surreptitiously because they're sitting too close. And I said, well, his skin is so dry because he just keeps putting lotion in the basket. Anyway, for my podcast plugs for this week on the Our Vantage Point podcast, instead of plugging their last show, I urge you to check out their next show this Monday, which will be episode 100. Kind of funny how they have episode 100 on the same day as the Place to Be Nation's 500th episode, Trivia Spectacular. So a lot going on early next week. Do check out the 100th episode of the Our Vantage Point podcast. You might be hearing a little clip from me saluting them for their 100th episode. On the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, they do a segment with Brian Malonis where they read mean tweets about him, which is always a favorite of mine because it gets Brian very riled up. He's a nice guy. I don't know why people are so mean to him on Twitter. I mean, if you all just took the time to fly to one of his shows and do the meet and greet and all, I'm sure you'll see that he is a very nice human being. And on the Sportscasters with my sometimes podcast partner, Steve Bennett, he had Joe Buck as one of his guests on his last show. I do urge you to check out the Sportscaster's very impressive Rolodex that Steve Bennett has. And somehow I'm on it too. I don't know how that would have happened. But I have one final piece of business, and it is another quick edition of YouTube Comment Theater. And as usual, these are actual YouTube comments posted on the video on YouTube. There are not that many of them this week to choose from, so I'm actually going to go through the entire thing. I think there's only four of them as there are. First one, Christopher Howe says, "It was a much better produced show as soon as Bischoff seized creative control." I think that's a matter of some conjecture. You have the Florida tapings once Bischoff takes over, which is, of course, an effort to save money. I rather liked the 1993 Worldwide that I did a couple of weeks ago, where they were in an arena similar to how almost any other wrestling show would be shot. It kind of looked the same. But the set here was kind of cool with the New York City vibe, where Pillman is running out of an automobile and you have other guys coming out of buildings. It certainly lent some sort of uniqueness to this whole thing. Donnie Brook, it says that is his name on here. It says pro wrestler, and I think it's UFO enthusiast or something. If you look it up, it goes into that whole deal. By the way, I did not go to Roswell, New Mexico, because that is just too far away. "I was crying on this day, but not for the reason you would think. And I looked up what was going on, and I couldn't really figure out what the hell he was talking about. Saturday, June 25th, 1994. Like I said, the OJ thing had happened well before this, a week and a half. The chase was 8 days before this. The NBA Finals were over. The NHL Stanley Cup Finals were over. Even the riots in Vancouver were over by this point. So I have no idea what this guy is talking about, and I actually spent valuable time trying to figure out what he was talking about. Robbie Rupak says, "What a hidden gem this episode is. The steroid-free Hulkster, promoting Hulkamania like no other, with Jimmy Mouth of the South as his first manager ever as a babyface. Wow, so much in that cheesy intro. Ric Flair upset Hogan brought up Ted Turner. Laughed my ass off. Brian Pillman with his party in the back business in the front haircut. LOL. Wow. All being shot on the set of Universal Studios. The crowd was clearly not really the greatest environment, but Jesse Ventura still hates Hogan and Mean Gene asking questions. Still asking questions. Some things never change." I don't think anybody ever accused him maybe of being steroid free. He was probably steroid lower at the time, I would say. The crowd, I thought, was actually very good for this show. I mean, I've heard worldwide crowds that are just way more antiseptic than this, so I certainly disagree with that assessment. And no, Jimmy Mouth of the South Heart was not his first manager as a babyface, because technically Elizabeth was Hulk Hogan's manager for that brief period in 1989. So I'm going to call shenanigans on that one. And Donnie Brook replied to that and said, "Hogan, steroid-free, LOL, never." I hate it when people put LOL in there, because then I have to read it as it is, and it really just kind of bothers me. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As always, I thank you so much for listening, and leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music. That is always appreciated for both me and the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well. And you can go to prowrestlingonly.com/GFAllentownPod, and you can catch up on all my back catalog from there. And at that point, you can check out the rest of the Pro Wrestling Only site. As I said, there's a lot to look at as you go through the site. If you're just a simple man into wrestling magazine covers, you could do that, or you could go into serious match analysis. As for next week's show, I have not necessarily made up my mind on what I'm going to do. It will probably be a WWF show from back in the day, but I'm not entirely clear on which year I'm going to do. I was looking at a show from early 85. I was looking at a show from early 87, which is what I'm leaning towards. I had mentioned that on Twitter a while back. And then another show for which I've already taken notes from 1996 that has a relatively famous angle on it. But I may hold that back for a week or two, just to a week where maybe I don't have as much time to take notes. And that one, I actually already have the notes and all the stuff written out. So just to provide some transparency on it. So Do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.